Birth of the Renaissance. And this is a chapter in a book by Jacques Le Goff called Must We Divide History into Periods? And we found out about him because Markley had mentioned that he has a different view of the Middle Ages. He's essentially an expert, I guess, in the Middle Ages. And he doesn't accept the novelty, let's say, of the Renaissance, but rather he's trying to push the idea of a long Middle Ages from the end of antiquity to the mid-18th century. But this chapter is a good way, I guess, to like as an intro into his ideas, even though it's halfway through his book. So he's also trying to dispute the idea of really fixed periods in history with sharp beginnings and endings. Birth of the Renaissance. We have seen that the idea of one period giving way to another as darkness gives way to light was advanced for the first time in the 14th century by Petrarch. But darkness could follow light as well. The glorious Greco-Roman period, extinguished in the 4th century, was succeeded in the poet's view by a time of barbarism, the dimming of civilization. Hence the need to rediscover the modes of thinking and writing that had been perfected by the ancients. But the quote Renaissance, as well as the idea of a splendid era of history that was associated with this name after the Middle Ages and in opposition to them, dates only from the 19th century. They are due to Jules Michelet, whose life spanned from 1798 to 1874. As a young man, and still when the first volume of his Historia de France appeared in 1833, Michelet thought of the Middle Ages as a period of light and creativity, a fruitful and radiant era that drew to a close with the approach of the 16th century and the Reformation. Looking back almost 40 years later, Michelet noted that in seeking to give a full picture of medieval France, he was the first historian to have consulted a new category of materials. Quote, until 1830, even until 1836, none of the remarkable historians of this era had yet felt the need to look for facts outside published books, in primary sources, most of them therefore unpublished, in the manuscripts in our libraries, in the documents of our archives. End quote. But these documents were only a springboard for the imagination, a stimulus to insight. In a famous passage that follows in the preface to the third edition of 1869 of his massive history, published in 5 volumes, Michelet evokes the voice of these archives. The voice that the historian hears in the privacy of the places where he works alone. Scholarship is merely the scaffolding that the artist, the historian, must push aside once his labours are finished. Michelet's Middle Ages were therefore the product as much of his personal vision and inspiration as of primary sources. They also traced out the pattern of his own life and personality. The Middle Ages he once knew, festive, luminous, exuberant, began to change during the course of the 1830s. Following the death of his first wife in 1839, he came to think of them as a period of gloom, of obscurantism, petrification, and sterility. Whereas once he felt as though he had rediscovered his childhood in the Middle Ages, to the point of imagining them as the womb from which he was issued, they now seemed but a distant memory, not merely foreign but hostile. He longed for a new light. This light was to be the Renaissance. In a landmark article on Michelet's invention of the Renaissance, Lucien Febvre, 1878 to 1956, pointed out that the attitude of many of the great writers of the first half of the 19th century, including Stendhal, Sainte-Beuve, Hugo, and Musset, toward, or Musset, I guess, toward the era between 1400 and 1600, underwent a change as well. But none of these authors, nor indeed anyone else at the time, used a specific term to designate this period. The reason is that historians and men of letters were not in the habit then of dividing history into periods. It was customary to distinguish between ancient, medieval, and modern, but nothing more. Febre observes that the term Renaissance, with a small r, was frequently used to speak of the rebirth of the arts, for example, or of the humanities. But Michelet, profoundly moved by what he interpreted as a force of resurrection in the course of history, was the first to give the period that began with the 15th century in Europe, and above all in Italy, the name Renaissance, with a capital R. Elected to the Collège de France in 1838, he delivered his inaugural lecture there on 23rd of April. The prestige of this forum provided Michelet with the opportunity to introduce the new name to an international audience in the years between 1840 and 1860, when it became established as a period. Michelet was captivated by two figures whom he was soon to write about in his History of France: the Duke of Burgundy, Charles the Bold, 1433 to 77, and Charles V of Spain, 1500 to 1558. The world in which Michelet himself lived was an ordinary little world by comparison, the bourgeois world of France in the time of Guizot and Augustin Thierry, consumed by a vulgar appetite for money. A word of hope, of clarity, of poetry had to come forth if literature and the mental habits of the nation were to be invigorated. The word came, and with it a new age, the Renaissance. But Michelet's Renaissance was not the rebirth or the revival of a splendid epoch that now lived on. It marked the end of, quote, that bizarre and monstrous, prodigiously artificial state, the Christian Middle Ages. Michelet's pessimism swallowed up an era he had once found reason only to admire. With his lectures at the Collège de France in the first 2 months of 1840, the historical landscape was utterly transformed. The Middle Ages had been eclipsed. A star was born, the Renaissance. Michelet could not help but bring it into the world, for as he confessed, quote, having met with it in me, it became me. His opening lecture that semester began with a review of the history of France since Roman Gaul. Arriving at the end of the 15th century, Michelet declared, quote, we have come to the Renaissance through the phrase return to life. Thus we come into the light. Following on Marco Polo's travels in China and accompanying Christopher Columbus's discovery of America, the Renaissance seems to him to mark the beginning of globalization. It also represents the triumph of the people over monarchies and nations. He sees, quote, emerge from the Middle Ages the newborn modern world. The central figure was everyone, and the author of this great change is man. Brought forth by God, man is like him a creator. The modern world was his creation, a new world that the Middle Ages could not contain within its negative polemics. Whence the title of the second lecture, delivered 3 days later on 9th of January, quote, man's victory over God. Michelet conceives of the Renaissance as, quote, passage to the modern world, end quote, signalling a return to paganism, to pleasure, to sensuality, to liberty. Italy had taught it to the other European nations, to France first in the course of the Italian Wars, and then to Germany and to England. The Renaissance thus set in motion the age of history, whose interpreter is the historian. His teaching is dedicated to illuminating the process of humanity after its long solitary exile in the Middle Ages. The lectures of the following year, 1841, took as their theme the, quote, eternal renaissance. They bear principally on Italy and on everything that France owed to it. Michelet sees an interdependence between the two countries from the time of Julius Caesar, a fertile marriage, as he calls it, a, quote, long union perpetuated by religion, art and law. He claims that, quote, the Italian principle that fertilized France is above all the geometrical spirit, the principle of order applied to civil society, the construction of the great channels of communication. Roman roads went in every direction. Thus it was that, in inaugurating the Italian wars, the French king Charles VIII, quote, went looking for civilization on the other side of the Alps. Michelet then goes on to describe a country of superb cities, beginning with Florence, then Pisa, Genoa, Venice, Milan, and finally Rome. Its beauty and its wealth attracted conquerors who came away with a magnificent haul of treasures, not the least of which was liberty. The greatness of Florence is summed up by the Dominican friar Savonarola, an inspired reformer. Michelet praises the charm of the city and the splendour not only of its cathedral, but also of the Basilica di Santa Croce, where Michelangelo was buried. The papacy, he says, is to be admired for placing its power in the service of the arts. Rid of the Borgias, it regained the radiance it had enjoyed under Julius II, the patron of Machiavelli and Michelangelo. Alongside, quote, the dramatic beauty of Lombardy and Florence, end quote, the wonders of Rome, Naples' glorious history by itself forms the subject of an entire lecture. Next, Michelet recalls some of the treasures that France brought back from Italy. Evokes Venice and its freedom of passion, of physical pleasure, of well-being, freedom in the service of art, and then proceeds to contemplate the artistic flowering of Florence. Aldus Manutius, 1449 to 1515, and the development of printing in Venice. Everywhere he notices a passion for engraving. He mentions the study of anatomy and the human body, the magnificent dome of St. Peter's in Rome, and the influence of women. Michelet concludes his account of this modern age, this Renaissance, with a mystical appeal to the coincidence of life and scholarship. He emphasizes the historian's obligation to express the unanimous voice of the crowd, for, quote, the modern age is the advent of this crowd, the truly blessed moment when a mute world found its voice. The spirit of hope that infuses the work of the historian leads him back to himself, quote, I have this hope in me. History, he says, is a resurrection from the dead. Feeling myself die, he said, I myself am in need of resurrection. Apparently referring to the year when he gave his first course of lectures at the Collège de France, he ends with these words, loving the dead is my immortality. Despite Michelet's lasting influence, the invention of the Renaissance as a period was long credited by educated people in France to the historian Jacob Burckhardt of 1818 to 97. Burckhardt's work, Die Kultur der Renaissance in Italien, The Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy, was first published in 1860. It was brought out in a second edition in 1869, and then another 9 years later in a third edition, altered to the point of mutilation, before a definitive text was finally established in 1922 by the noted German scholar Walter Goetz. Burckhardt, a German-speaking Swiss who had studied in Berlin under Leopold von Ranke, the founder of the German Historical School, taught the history of art at the University of Basel between 1844 and his retirement in 1886. Apart from rather brief trips to Germany and, more frequently, Italy, he spent the whole of his professional career in Switzerland. Initially, he had intended to produce a history of the art of the Italian Renaissance, but for some reason or other, he abandoned art for civilization, culture. At an early stage of his preparations. The scope of the project made it both a model and a source for future research in European cultural history generally. I should therefore like to devote the rest of the present chapter to a brief summary of its main points. Burckhardt's famous work is divided into six parts. In the first part, quote, "The State as a Work of Art," he looks back on the history of the tyrants and the great nobles of Italy from the 13th century to the 16th. He takes particular note of Venice, where he observes that, quote, "humanistic culture is, for a city of such importance, most scantily represented," and of Florence, which he calls the first modern state in the world. He remarks on the early appearance in these two places of statistical science, among other instruments of power, together with a certain backwardness in their arts, at least at first, by comparison with the other great cities of the Renaissance in Italy. The foreign policy of the Italian states was shaped by a mutual interest in achieving and maintaining a balance among them through a purely objective treatment of international affairs. With such men, Burckhardt says, speaking of the statesmen of this period, negotiation was possible. It might be presumed that they would be convinced and their opinion modified when practical reasons were laid before them. He then goes on to consider war as a work of art. Turning to the papacy, he sees as a danger to Italy, which he sees as a danger to Italy, he dwells at some length on unrest in the city of Rome, aggravated by the simony and nepotism practiced by the popes, especially Sixtus IV. 40 years later, Clement VII, a member of the Medici family, which had compromised itself in its dealings with the pontifical authorities, as the Borgia family had done before it, provoked the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V into sending his troops to Italy, where they sacked Rome in 1527. Yet there is no limit to Burckhardt's praise of Leo V, though he too was a Medici. Of this pontiff, Burckhardt makes a point of saying, quote, "We shall often meet with him in treating of the noonday of the Renaissance." The second part of Burckhardt's book is concerned with the development of the individual. A man of this new age, who carries his culture inside him, feels at ease everywhere. Burckhardt quotes an exiled humanist who consoles himself with the thought, quote, "Wherever a learned man fixes his seat, there is home." By contrast with the Middle Ages, where the individual was subject to the constraints of religion, social environment, and the force of prevailing custom, the man of the Renaissance could develop his personality without hindrance. This was the age of the universal man, a man such as Leon Battista Alberti, architect, mathematician, painter, one of the first great authors of the period to write in the vulgar tongue, Italian rather than Latin. Burckhardt is interested also in the love of glory, which he sees as characteristic of the societies of the Renaissance. Dante had vigorously criticized the growing passion for personal fame. By Petrarch's time, glory was sought not only by individuals and families, but also by cities. It was celebrated everywhere, in the tombs of the most distinguished families, in the cult of the great men of antiquity, in the emergence of local celebrities. It triumphed in literature, and writers distributed the laurels. In the third part, Burckhardt examines what he calls the resurrection of humanity, which took the form of, quote, a new birth, that is, a return to a glorious past. Quote, it was not the revival of antiquity alone, he emphasizes, but its union with the genius of the Italian people, which achieved the conquest of the Western world. Once again, Italy finds itself at the heart of the periodization of history. The ruins of Rome were an object of special reverence. Old authors were rediscovered and popularized. The humanist literature restored to poetry the eminence it had formerly enjoyed in ancient Greece and Rome. Humanism developed as much among the urban professional classes as in the courts of the nobility and the Roman curia. Occasional literature and oratory once again became a familiar part of social life. Congratulatory addresses, speeches of welcome and commemoration, funeral orations, political harangues, academic lectures, sermons in Latin, all of them adorned with quotations from classical authors. Latin, which had been on the verge of being replaced in everyday communication by vernaculars, acquired once more an absolute value in humanist and curial circles. Burckhardt speaks even of the, quote, general Latinization of culture. And yet, despite their matchless brilliance, the humanists failed. Their vanity, their artificially, and, as the rising leaders of the Counter-Reformation complained, the insecurity of their Christian faith caused them to fall into disgrace in the 16th century. In the final three parts of his book, Burckhardt comes back to the things that he sees as constituting the heart of the Renaissance. The fourth part looks not only at the discovery of man, the foundation of humanism, but also at the discovery of the world, which gave rise to astronomy, botany and gardens, zoology and collections of exotic animals. In discovering the world, the Renaissance came to appreciate the beauty of nature. Petrarch may have been the first to sing of the joys of mountain climbing. The Flemish school's use of oils gave painted landscapes a new vividness and appeal. Beauty also made its power felt in portraiture, both in painting and in literature. In Italy, and above all in Tuscany, biography flourished. But autobiography, associated with the emergence of the individual, began to be written as well. One of the most remarkable self-portraits of any age is due to the celebrated goldsmith Benvenuto Cellini. The other great characteristic of social life in the Renaissance, which Burckhardt takes up in the fifth part, is the festival. Religious celebrations in particular, processions of various sorts, the Feast of Corpus Christi, and mystery plays performed in front of churches, all preserved their prestige and in some places actually became more numerous. At the same time, secular festivals, sponsored by villages or local nobles, took on a quite singular splendour. In the domain of costume, the Renaissance signalled both the birth and the intensification of fashion. Purism and preciosity occupied an unprecedented place in conversation. Noble ladies presided over salons, noble men, if they were politicians like the Medicis, over circles. A profile of the perfect man of society began to take shape. His body sculpted by physical exercise, his movements given rhythmical grace by music, he aspired not only to be but also to appear to be. Women participated in this cultural transformation as equals. Their education differed in no essential way from the one men received. Many women wrote novels and poems, even courtesans were notable for their intelligence and culture. Family life took an artistic turn, with the head of the household conducting a sort of orchestra, and its pleasures came increasingly to be enjoyed in the setting of the villa, a country house of wealthy Italian burgers. From the painting of the period, it is apparent that the countryside was now more closely linked to the city than it had been during the Middle Ages. The sixth and final part of Burckhardt's work consists, somewhat oddly as it may seem, of a series of reflections on morality and religion that leave the reader with a rather disagreeable impression of the Renaissance as a whole. With regard to morality, he detects a universal instinct for evil. Nowhere was a talent for vile behaviour cultivated more assiduously than in Italy. Quote, "In this country, finally, where individuality of every sort attained its highest development, we find instances of that ideal and absolute wickedness which delights in crimes for their own sake, and not as a means to an end, or at any rate as means to ends for which our psychology has no measure." Yet Italy remains for Burckhardt the scene of, quote, "the first mighty surging of a new age in the history of the world." Through his gifts and his passions, the Italian of the Renaissance has become the most characteristic representative of all the heights and all the depths of his time. By the side of profound corruption appeared human personalities of the noblest harmony and an artistic splendour which shed upon the life of man a lustre which neither antiquity nor medievalism either could or would bestow upon it. In the domain of religion, Burckhardt regrets both the failure of Savonarola's reformist preaching and the limited success of the Protestant Reformation, laments the laxity of the faithful and their desertion of the churches, and casts doubt once more on the sincerity of the Christian belief professed by the humanists. The Christian societies of the Renaissance are nonetheless not wholly deserving of blame in this regard. Burckhardt speaks favourably of the tolerance shown toward Islam and praises the interest taken not only in pagan expressions of religious feeling, but also in philosophical movements of antiquity that were incompatible with Christian doctrine, such as Epicureanism. He is especially impressed by the spirit of open-mindedness in entertaining the idea of free will and sees the thinkers of this time as theoreticians and practitioners of an admirable impartiality. Burckhardt is also alert to the influence exerted by superstition, particularly in its pseudo-scientific guise. He notes the spread of astrology and belief in ghosts, demons, witches, and the special kind of sorcery practiced by prostitutes, describes the magical properties associated with laying the foundations of a house or church or city, and notes by contrast the diminishing fascination with alchemy. Burckhardt concludes his book with a discussion of the general weakening of faith. Atheism is not yet openly avowed, but theism has plainly yielded to unbelief. The effect of the Renaissance has been to produce a general secularization.